WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Dennis Ross was the chief Middle East peace negotiator in the administrations of Bill Clinton and George H.W. Bush. On today's Fresh Air, we talk about Ross's recent trip to Jerusalem and Ramallah. He says the big issue wasn't the stalemate in the peace process, it was the conflict between the Palestinian organizations Hamas and Fatah, and whether Gaza was already lost to Islamist extremists. We'll also talk about some of Ross's experiences as Middle East negotiator and his current thoughts about dealing with Iran and Syria. Ross has written a new book called Statecraft and How to Restore America's Standing in the World. He's critical of the current administration's lack of statecraft. Also, Ken Tucker reviews the CD from country singer Miranda Lambert. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest Dennis Ross was the chief Middle East peace negotiator in the administrations of Bill Clinton and George H.W. Bush. Ross is now a distinguished fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. He's written a new book called Statecraft and How to Restore America's Standing in the World. As we'll hear later, he's critical of President George W. Bush for his administration's absence of statecraft. Dennis Ross, welcome to Fresh Air. Now, you recently traveled to Jerusalem and Ramallah, and you say that the big issue wasn't the stalemate in the peace process. It was the conflict between the Palestinian organizations Hamas and Fatah, and whether Gaza was already lost to the Islamists. Would you describe the fear that Gaza is becoming an Islamist enclave?
Interestingly enough, what I heard from Israelis and Palestinians alike, although there wasn't uniformity on either side, is that Gaza was already lost, and it was well on its way to becoming an Islamist enclave, which they called Hamasstan. And the danger they saw was that this would create a sense of accomplishment, add further momentum to the Islamists, not only among the Palestinians, but region-wide, and would also be a kind of enclave where weapons and terrorists and people from Iran and from Lebanon, meaning Hezbollah, would be coming and providing training, and it would, in a sense, it would radiate outwards. It wouldn't be something that would be isolated or so easily isolated. Worse, from an Israeli standpoint, was the fear that much larger weapons in terms of capability, quality, range would be smuggled in, and suddenly it wouldn't only be Sderot, the town that's just across the border, that would be subjected to rocket fire. It could be many other cities in Israel as well.
What are the signs that Gaza has already become an Islamist enclave?
The most profound sign cited by both was the military prowess of Hamas. The buildup that Hamas has had militarily, the infrastructure it's developing, and its capacity to go after leading Fatah figures, leading Fatah security targets, and be successful in terms of most engagements. Having said that, there were many others who said, look, they may have the upper hand, meaning Hamas may have the upper hand, but they don't have control. There are 47 militias within Gaza. There's a struggle ongoing, and one shouldn't write Gaza off, certainly before it takes place.
Would you say that the majority of the Palestinians who live in Gaza are Islamists?
I would not say that. I would say that the majority of Palestinians in Gaza right now are neither. They're not Islamists. They're not for Fatah. They want to have a normal life. They would like to see law and order restored. Gaza has become almost Hobbesian in terms of its lawlessness, its anarchy. I mentioned 47 militias. What most Gazans right now would actually like to see is some order. Kidnappings are the order of the day. Gunfights are the order of the day. People increasingly find it difficult to do anything, and the functional unemployment in Gaza right now is approaching 70%.
What would it mean for the possibility of a Middle East peace or a two-state solution if Gaza remains Islamist?
Well, it really makes it difficult to produce a two-state solution as it was originally conceived. For Palestinians, they've always said a Palestinian state would be the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and Gaza, and that this is an integrated territorial unit, in their words. So if Gaza is not part of it, and you have probably 1.3 million Palestinians who are in Gaza who are not part of a Palestinian state because they're somehow removed because they reject the idea of a two-state solution, at least the leaders who are there who dominate the scene reject it, then it's pretty hard to envision a two-state solution the way we have in the past. On the other hand, some of the Palestinians I talked to said, look, let's make the West Bank work. Let's connect it, at least in a confederal way, starting economically to Jordan, maybe even some connection economically to the Israelis. Let's show, in contrast to Gaza, how well this works, and maybe over time we'll be able to convince those who are in Gaza to rise up against the Hamas, or we in Fatah and the independents will have the strength to be able to compete because we have a successful model. And if we don't, we'll just have a three-state solution. Now, I find the notion of a three-state solution pretty implausible, in part because I think psychologically Palestinians can never really accept that they won't have a state that has both Gaza and the West Bank in it. I think the potential for Gaza to be a continuing source of turmoil and trouble, especially if you can't isolate it from a military standpoint and the Israelis feel the need to go back in, I just see it as a continuing source of difficulty and conflict, which will make any stable two-state solution highly unlikely.
Well, let's get back to the idea of the plan to try to make the West Bank an alternative to Gaza, something that works economically and politically, in the hopes that the people in Gaza would say, well, we don't want these extremists. We prefer what's happening in the West Bank. We prefer that kind of life. What would that take, and how likely do you think it is that could happen?
Well, one interesting thing that I did find, and I must say, having been over there, it was not a time of feeling particularly hopeful and optimistic, even though I'm normally someone who's always looking for ways to solve problems. The fact is, what was interesting at the end of this trip, after hearing a lot about Iran, hearing a lot about Syria, hearing a lot about Hezbollah, seeing turmoil everywhere, I also heard from a wide range of Palestinians, and I saw over 30 of them covering of the what I call the old guard of Fatah, the young guard of Fatah, the second and third generations of Fatah, and a number of independents as well. I saw a recognition that those in the West Bank felt, look, if we can't get our act together, if we can't begin to organize ourselves at the grassroots, if we can't make and build our institutions and show that they can work, we don't have a future as a people. We don't have a future as a nation. And I think that's an important potential development. So in answer to your question, I guess what I would say is, building from the ground up, building institutions from the ground up, assuming a culture of accountability, demonstrating that with some help and connection to Jordan and from donors on the outside who would invest in serious private sector efforts within the West Bank, which, by the way, is a whole lot better off economically even today than Gaza is, then you could begin to create a functioning, viable economic, political, and social reality in the West Bank. And it could stand up as something that shows Palestinians there is a way forward. I don't mean to suggest that it's disconnected from a political process, because Palestinians have to feel there's also a prospect for achieving their national aspirations. But I think first things first, creating organization at the grassroots level, demonstrating that, in fact, you can compete with the Islamists is probably a starting point.
Would that organization likely be Fatah or an alternative to Fatah?
It's going to be Fatah, even though it's going to have to be Fatah in a way that I call rebranding Fatah, because the Fatah name, as it were, while it's still synonymous with the national movement, is also synonymous now with corruption and selfishness. So you've got to create a demonstration that Fatah can remake itself and be responsive to people's needs, not to the needs of the movement or the faction. So I think it would be Fatah. And one of the reasons I say that, again, it's not me so much saying it as the people I talked to, including independents, who said, look, there's no third way for Palestinians. It's either going to be Fatah or Hamas. These are the only two seriously organized movements that exist. There are lots of offshoots, splinter groups from each. The key is not to look for some kind of third force, third way that's independent. The key is to make Fatah work.
Well, your new book is called Statecraft. Do you think that there's a place for American diplomacy in trying to prevent Gaza and the West Bank from becoming Islamist?
I do, and I think one of the keys to statecraft, as I describe in the book, is that you have to have reality-based assessments. You can't have faith-based assessments. You have to do a hard-headed look at what the situation is. And if you want to change it, you have to understand it well before you can change it. So first things first, I would focus on this competition between Fatah and Hamas, because even if we have a political process, or even if we produce a ceasefire, which in a sense is something I call for in the book, the fact is, whether you have a ceasefire or you have a political process, both will end up being largely irrelevant if Hamas ends up winning this competition, number one. Number two, even if one wants Hamas to change, the best prospect of changing Hamas so that it comes to accept coexistence is if it has internal competition politically, economically, and socially. People tend to forget that Hamas built its following, to the extent that it has it, not on the basis of jihad alone. It built it on the basis of what's known as the Dawah. Literally, this has been the place where Hamas built recruitment, provided social services, in a sense created a social underpinning, a social welfare system. And what, in a sense, smart statecraft would do right now is to focus on how to compete and help those who want to compete with the Islamists as part of a larger strategy. As I said, it wouldn't take the place necessarily of going for a comprehensive ceasefire, which would have to be worked out in great detail. It wouldn't take the place even of trying to develop a political process that would point the way towards larger political issues. But if you pursue those two tracks and you don't pursue this particular track, you're not going to achieve where you want to go anyway. So smart statecraft at this point would recognize what the situation is, would identify with those people who want to remake Fatah, would organize the donor community, including the Saudis and the Gulf states, to work with those who are prepared to work for themselves in Fatah. And I very much met with many of those who I saw are prepared to roll up their sleeves, organize themselves, remake Fatah for their own reasons, for their own salvation, not as a favor to anybody on the outside.
So who are the countries that you think have a vested interest in preventing the Gaza and the West Bank from becoming militant Islamist enclaves?
Well, certainly we do. I would say the Europeans do. And I would also say the Saudis, the Gulf states, Egypt, Jordan, Morocco, Tunisia. This becomes part and parcel of a larger struggle with those who want to transform the Middle East and turn the clock back, as it were. I would say the Saudis in particular, who don't want this conflict, meaning the Palestinian conflict, to be exploited by Iran, they don't want it to be a stick that is used against them. They have a real interest in ensuring that Hamas doesn't take over all the Palestinian institutions, because it'll guarantee enduring conflict. And if that's the case, you're going to find that the Saudis will find this is a problem that is used against them. And the Saudis and the other Gulf states certainly have the wherewithal to help invest in an alternative to the Islamists.
My guest is Dennis Ross. He was the chief Middle East peace negotiator in the administrations of George H.W. Bush and Bill Clinton. His new book is called Statecraft. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Dennis Ross. He was the chief Middle East peace negotiator in the Clinton administration. Before that, in the administration of George H.W. Bush, he served as director of the State Department's Policy Planning Office. His new book is called Statecraft, How to Restore America's Standing in the World. Well, we've been talking about the fears that Gaza has become an Islamist enclave and that the same might be starting to happen in the West Bank. Now, Syria has supported Hamas and Hezbollah. Israel has reportedly approached Syria about peace talks, approached Syria through third-party channels, reportedly Germany and Turkey. What do you think Syria's motive is in being interested in talks with Israel?
I think that Syria, and certainly President Assad, probably sits on the fence right now between two different alternatives, one being pursuing peace with Israel, and the other is actually ending up in a conflict with Israel. I think two factors may influence him. One, obviously, is the Golan Heights. It would be a stunning achievement if Syria could get the Golan Heights back. His father certainly wanted to do so, and in the end didn't succeed. The other would be, and I think this is the main preoccupation of the regime, there's an international tribunal that is now set to be established after June 10th, I guess starting this week, I think. That international tribunal would, in fact, prosecute those responsible for the killing of the former prime minister of Lebanon, Hariri. And the Syrians know that the investigation to date points a pretty large finger at the Syrian leadership. So for someone like Bashar Assad, trying to get out from under that tribunal may be one of his main motivations. If it looks like he thinks that he's making Syria indispensable to peace, that might reduce the incentives in the international community to pursue the tribunal to its final results.
Is there anyone in Hamas or Fatah for Israel to negotiate with?
Well, I certainly believe there's someone within Fatah, and that is Abu Mazen, the president of the Palestinian Authority, and the people around him. I think there is a value in talking to him. I think there is a value in creating a political process. I think we should also at the same time recognize what's possible and what isn't. One of the complaints I've had about the administration's approach on this is they've
been pursuing... The Bush administration or the Israeli?
The Bush administration. The Bush administration's approach has been to, and this is what the Secretary of State wants to do, is to pursue a political horizon. Now, she means by political horizon the contours of a permanent status agreement which would resolve the issues of Jerusalem, refugees, and borders. Now, these are the existential questions. They involve the toughest compromises that are going to have to be made by each side. And we're looking at a divided leadership on the Palestinian side. Abu Mazen's intentions are clearly, in my mind, good intentions, but his capabilities are at best limited. In the case of the Prime Minister of Israel, you have someone with a 2% approval rating, which, of course, is within the margin of errors of the polls. So you're at a point where you have extremely weak leaders who are not really capable of making what I call compromises on the existential issues. So if you force them to deal with those questions, you're not going to produce very good responses. Now, if you had the Arab world prepared to embrace the core trade-offs on Jerusalem, refugees, borders, and security, that would be one thing. And the Arab League resolution demonstrates there's a readiness to maintain a commitment to a two-state solution. But all you got out of the Arab League resolution was basically a commitment to a two-state solution and an umbrella to begin negotiations, not an umbrella for concluding them. So if you're not at a point where the circumstances, where the reality permits you to take on that kind of a question, all you're doing is you're creating an objective that you can't achieve. Again, from a statecraft perspective, one of the things you don't want to do is create objectives that are completely divorced from your means because you end up discrediting yourselves and your objectives.
After years of trying to negotiate peace between Israelis and Palestinians, what is it like for you to watch Palestinians fighting with each other? And are similar problems coming up in the way Palestinians are reacting to each other as, you know, compared to the ways they reacted to Israelis?
One of the interesting things as someone like me takes a look at this is that I really sort of regret seeing a complete loss of a sense of possibility and a credible peace process, which we have not really had since 2001. I say that in answer to your question because the internal fighting among Palestinians is at least in part triggered by a sense of hopelessness. If you have a sense of hope, then groups, the Islamists, have much less upon which to make their case. When there's hopelessness, they're in a much stronger position. The more we see fragmentation among Palestinians, ironically, of course, then the harder it is to make peace. Now, you've got to start with a baseline of Palestinians who have objectives and can deliver on those objectives. Right now, those who have objectives in Hamas are pursuing a set of objectives that are against the very idea of a two-state solution, against the idea of coexistence, and in favor of the creation of an Islamic State. They might accept ceasefires and truces with the Israelis for certain periods of time. And there can be a value for that just in terms of preventing the killing. But the truth is, in terms of trying to create peace and try to foster reconciliation and coexistence, Hamas represents a move in the wrong direction. And the intra-Palestinian fighting at one level obviously is symptomatic of how difficult it's going to be now to try to move towards peace. Having said all that, again, I still retain a sense of possibility because I look at polls among Palestinians that still show 70% to 75% who would like to see a two-state solution. And that suggests that the mainstream of the Palestinians don't accept the political agenda of Hamas.
One of your criticisms of Palestinians in the Middle East peace negotiation process back when you were actively participating in that was that they used their historic victimization as a negotiating strategy. Now, when you're dealing with two Palestinian groups trying to get power from each other, you know, trying to compete for power with each other, then the victimization of Palestinians isn't an issue because that's something that both groups share.
Right.
So do you
but
see...
I'll tell you,
yeah, go ahead.
I was just say, where it comes into play is that a strategy of victimization creates a sense of entitlement. It creates a sense that you're never the one at fault, you never made any mistakes, you never have to learn from it, and ultimately you're never responsible. One of the things that has to change is the development of a culture of accountability and the need for Palestinians in the first instance to be accountable to themselves. The more they develop a culture of accountability, the more they have a sense that someone on the Palestinian side has to be responsible for Palestinians, the more at some point they'll be capable of being responsible to others as well. That's why I say that what I see now among Fatah, at least, is much more of a recognition that they have to, in a sense, roll up their sleeves. They have to show they can produce. They have to show they can be responsible. They have to show they can be accountable. And in a sense, the more they do that, the more they put Hamas in a similar position. Bear in mind that Hamas is both a government and a movement. Whenever there's been a conflict between the movement and the government, it's always the movement that has dominated to this point. I would suggest that the more that Fatah becomes effective in competing, the more the Hamas government is going to have to feel, or at least the internal Hamas is going to have to feel, that they're going to have to show they can also be responsible and deliver for Palestinians.
Dennis Ross is the author of the new book Statecraft on how to restore America's standing in the world. He was the chief Middle East peace negotiator in the administrations of Bill Clinton and George H.W. Bush. Ross will be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Delta Trade Paperbacks, publisher of In Pale Battalions by Robert Goddard, a suspense novel that explores the consequences of one family's secrets. From the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, supporting the Museum of Modern Art in Midtown Manhattan. Information at moma.org. And from Anne and John Herman, supporting City Year, and the young adults who dedicate a year of their lives to community service and leadership development, cityyear.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Ken Tucker reviews Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, the new CD from country singer Miranda Lambert. And Dennis Ross looks back on his experiences as a Middle East peace negotiator in the administrations of George H.W. Bush and Bill Clinton, and offers his suggestions for dealing with Iran.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Dennis Ross. He was the chief Middle East peace negotiator in the administrations of George H.W. Bush and Bill Clinton. He's currently a distinguished fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Ross is critical of the current administration's lack of statecraft. He's written a new book called Statecraft and How to Restore America's Standing in the World. How do you think U.S. diplomacy could be used now in stopping Iran's nuclear program?
Well, again, I take a look at where we are, and one of the things I see is that we have an objective of stopping Iran's nuclear program, and we have diplomacy that I describe as slow-motion diplomacy working through the Security Council. The good news about that is that there is a consensus that Iran shouldn't have a nuclear weapon expressed through the Security Council. There is a consensus that Iran, in fact, should stop this program, and that's the good news. The bad news is the pace at which the diplomacy is proceeding is not keeping pace with the effort to develop a nuclear capability. So what we're going to have to do, if we're going to bring our objectives and means into line, is focus on how we can accelerate and intensify the pressure on Iran using economic means in particular. I'm hopeful in this regard because we've seen that even limited sanctions produced a public debate within the Iranian leadership. Understand that everybody in the Iranian leadership wants to have nuclear weapons. They see it as a symbol of national power. They see it through a defensive lens. They see it through an offensive lens. They see it giving them great strength within the region as a whole where they feel they have a right to dominate. All these factors notwithstanding, we've also seen that there are many within the leadership, I would say the mullahs represented by Rafsanjani, the liberalizers represented by Hatemi, they are very much aware of the cost of isolation. They don't want to pay an economic price that threatens, in their view, social tranquility within Iran. So we have leverage. One of the keys right now is to get the Europeans who've been keen on applying pressure against Iran in an incremental way, get them to accelerate it. One way that I would try to affect the Europeans is basically to work with the Saudis. The Saudis have enormous financial holdings within Europe. The Saudis view an Iran with nuclear weapons almost as much of a threat as the Israelis do. From the Saudi standpoint, an Iran with nuclear weapons has a nuclear shield behind which to engage in coercion and subversion. And from a Saudi standpoint, it goes to the heart of what they're facing with Iran right now. They see themselves in a competition. They see themselves in a struggle. Now, if the Saudis understand for their own reasons, not because we want them to, that they could help, in effect, change the European approach to the Iranians, ratchet up the economic pressure, cut off what are close to $20 billion a year in credit guarantees to companies doing business with Iran, cut off access in Europe to Iranian banks, get European banks and investment houses not to do business with Iran. All of this could be done in parallel to the efforts that are underway at the Security Council, and yet would very much concentrate the mind of those within the Iranian leadership who understand the costs of pursuing a nuclear weapons program in terms of what its impact could be within Iran itself.
You have a lot of inside contacts around the world, and I don't know how many you have inside the Bush administration now, but I am wondering, do you think that the president is seriously considering attacking Iran?
When the president says that the military option has not been taken off the table, I believe that that's serious. I do think the balance of forces within the administration at this point is heavily in favor of not using force against Iran. And I think the key here is, in a sense, to begin to demonstrate that Iran's behavior will be changed. Those within the administration who favor the use of force would be those who would say and point to the diplomats in saying, look, you succeeded in producing international sanction against Iran, but you haven't succeeded in changing Iranian behavior, and we really can't live with an Iran with nuclear weapons. So while the balance of forces is tilted within the administration against those who would make that argument, it could change over time if we find by the end of the year that Iran crosses the threshold in terms of being able to enrich uranium. They're clearly getting close to being able to do that. They haven't solved all the technological problems, so we still have time to prevent that. And that's why I think a real effort to ratchet up the economic pressures right now are really essential.
I know that, you know, in your view of statecraft, there needs to be carrots and sticks, and the threat of force can be a very effective threat. while negotiations are going on. So either there's a kind of peaceful resolution to something or there's the threat of force. Do you think that the Bush administration has been using the threat of force against Iran in an effective way?
I think it's hard for them to use it effectively right now because the Iranians perceive us as being so tied down in Iraq and seeing themselves as having leverage on our position in Iraq that it's not so easy, point one. Point two, when the Secretary of State, in advance of the Sharm el-Sheikh conference that was held last month, on a number of occasions appealed for the Iranians to send their foreign minister at a time when the Iranians had said they were going to send a representative but they hadn't settled on a level, that also sent a message that somehow we were desperate to be dealing with them. Ahmadinejad came out and said that the U.S. had approached them 41 times. Again, I'm a big believer in engagement. I don't think we should be afraid of it. But I think it's very important to do it in a way where you send a message that you don't need the other side more than they need you. I think that's a key. You ask about the issue of force. I'm not sure they particularly believe it, but I do think one can make them more mindful of where the administration is going by the kinds of training exercises that are being held. And I do think at the same time, you have to bear in mind that you're trying to bring the Europeans along. So here's an area where there's a kind of tension. The more you focus on the use of force, the more you make the Europeans nervous. Now, if they think what they have to do to head you off from doing that is to engage in more economic pressures, that's a good thing. If they think that whatever they do isn't going to make a difference and you're determined to use force, that's a bad thing.
My guest is Dennis Ross. He was the chief Middle East peace negotiator in the administrations of George H.W. Bush and Bill Clinton. His new book is called Statecraft. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Dennis Ross, and he was the chief Middle East peace negotiator in the Clinton administration, and before that in the administration of George H.W. Bush. Ross served as director of the State Department's Policy Planning Office. He's now a distinguished fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. His new book is called Statecraft and How to Restore America's Standing in the World. During the lead-up to the Gulf War and during the Gulf War, this is 1990 and 91, you were in the State Department of President George H.W. Bush, and you write a little bit in your new book, Statecraft, about watching James Baker, who was then Secretary of State, putting together the coalition for the Gulf War. Give us an example of something he did in putting together the coalition that you consider to be a really good example of wise statecraft.
I'll give you a couple of examples because I think they really stand out and they stand in stark contrast to what was done in Bush administration 43. Number one, he traveled frequently to other capitals, including, for example, Turkey, but not only Turkey, when he was putting together the coalition. All these capitals that he went to, every time he did it, he gave the leaders he was meeting a public platform to demonstrate that the U.S. was being solicitous of their views, not trying to impose on them, because every one of his visits, what he said in public was, we're here to consult on what to do. In private, he would say, look, we're going to take these steps. We'd really like you to be with us. What can we do that makes it easier for you to be with us? So the public element of his trips were very much geared towards, in a sense, creating a political explanation for his hosts. We were never putting them in the corner. We were never trying to impose on them. We gave them, in a sense, a rationale for doing what they were doing, and we gave them the ability to explain it to their own publics. Connected to those trips, he understood that certain countries like Turkey and Egypt would pay an enormous economic price if they joined the coalition, given their economic ties, in a sense, dependency on Iraq. So he put together what came to be known as his Tin Cup exercises. What he did is raise money from the Saudis and others and the Germans and Japanese who weren't going to commit forces but could commit resources. He used the Tin Cup exercises to help sustain those who would find it difficult to be part of the coalition. So on the one hand, he made it easier for countries to join, and on the other hand, he made it easier for them to sustain their involvement in the coalition.
Now, in saying that he gave the countries who he wanted to be part of the coalition an argument that they could use to make to their own people, compare that to how you think President George W. Bush handled trying to put together a coalition.
Well, I think the essence of what we were doing was, you know, under the rubric of make the UN relevant. You're going to make yourself irrelevant if you don't join us. I mean, I'm not saying that there was no effort to bring others into the coalition, because there was. But contrast, for example, Turkey. In 1990-91 and in the year 2002-2003, Turkey was critical to a coalition. You could argue even more critical in 2003, because the original military plan called for our, in fact, not using just air forces but ground forces, staging out of northern, out of Turkey into northern Iraq. What happened in each case is that the Bush administration in 2002-2003, as opposed to 1991, never sent anybody above the Deputy Secretary of Defense to Turkey. Now, that's fine to send the Deputy Secretary of Defense, except that when you're sending him there, almost by definition, it's clear that this is all about the use of force. When you're sending the Secretary of State, who, by the way, went three times to Turkey from August of 1990 until January of 1991, the President of the United States called the Turkish leader between 55 and 60 times in the same time frame. It became part of the Turkish public story how their leader, Özal, was talking to President Bush, his friend, and that was a very credible thing. You didn't have anything comparable to that in 2002-2003. And yet, when the vote in the Turkish parliament was conducted on whether or not to allow us to use force from there, it lost by 3 out of 514 cast. Now, the mood in Turkey was pretty negative towards use of force in 2002-2003, but it was also pretty negative in the year 1991. So you have a pretty interesting contrast in terms of how things were done then and how things were done more recently.
You write a little bit in your book about working with President Clinton. As his Middle East peace negotiator, and you say you did a good cop bad cop thing with Clinton, but typically in a situation like that, the negotiator is the good cop. Except you play the role of the bad cop, and Clinton played the role of the good cop. How come?
I think one thing you need in any negotiation is for everybody to be authentic. And one thing about President Clinton, he had a capacity to use his incredible empathy and marry it to his understanding of detail to convince those he was dealing with that he understood why what he was asking them was the hardest thing they'd ever have to do. And he could do it in a very compelling way. It wasn't his strength, and it wasn't really who he was, to engage in what I call the tough love, to be the one to spell out all the consequences if they didn't cross a certain threshold. So inevitably, the division of labor became one where it was more natural for me to be the bad cop and for him to be the good cop.
But I think at the very end of the Clinton administration, in January, just days before he left office, when things were still on the edge with Yasser Arafat, that you basically tried to push Clinton into playing the bad cop to get Arafat to commit to a peace plan.
It's true. In the very last meeting at the White House on January 2nd, 2001, I felt it was really important for the president to make it clear to Arafat that he would hold him personally responsible, that he was, in a sense, by saying no to what the president had offered, he was making the president a failure. I wanted him to communicate it that way to Yasser Arafat. And he did convey a blunt message, but it was more geared towards that Arafat was killing Barack and there was nothing more that Clinton could do. Now, if you listen to that, that's a tough message. It's a blunt message. But for someone like Arafat, who didn't much care about the impact he had on Israelis and who might have cared about the impact he had on Americans, it probably wasn't the right message. The real question in the end is whether any message would have made a difference. I came to the conclusion that Arafat was simply incapable of transforming himself. He was simply incapable of being able to end the conflict. And so even if the president had conveyed the kind of really blunt message that I wanted, we probably still wouldn't have succeeded.
Why do you think Arafat was incapable of really ending the conflict?
I think fundamentally he was a man of the 1950s. He was a national liberation leader. He saw himself in historic terms. The movement itself came to define him, and he couldn't live without a movement. He couldn't live without grievance. He couldn't live without a cause. He couldn't live without struggle. And we were asking him to do what was the hardest thing for him, end the conflict, which meant no more claims, no more grievance, no more struggle, no more cause. And that was something he couldn't do. He could live with the process, he couldn't live with the conclusion. And I think in the end, I wish that I had recognized that earlier because I would have reshaped our objectives. Here's a good example of what I mean by statecraft. The key to good statecraft is always focusing on the objectives that you can achieve based upon understanding the situation that you're in and the means you can bring to bear. If, in fact, I were redefining what we would have done, I would have come up with a different set of objectives based upon the following test. I would have gone to Arafat and whoever the Israeli prime minister was at the time before we entered permanent status negotiations, and I would have said, we can't solve the core issues of this conflict with you, Jerusalem, refugees and borders, unless you are prepared publicly to go say to your people that each of you know you're going to have to compromise, each of you know you will not get 100% of what you want on Jerusalem, refugees and borders. Now, had we required that of each side, my guess is that Arafat wouldn't have been able to do it because he wasn't prepared to compromise on those issues because, in a sense, they went too much to the heart of his own definition of the cause. If he hadn't been able to do that, then we would have gone back to him and said, you know what, it's clear you can't really compromise on the core issues. We're not going to walk away from this process, but we're not going to focus on the permanent status issues. Instead, what we're going to do is we're going to create, as our process now, increasing the scope of independence of Palestinians from Israelis, increasing the ties between the Israelis and Palestinian societies, improving the economic situation, and in a sense, creating a context where life got better for both sides, where the extent of independence for Palestinians became more profound, where there might have been some additional withdrawals from territories by the Israelis. But we wouldn't have tackled the core issues that we couldn't solve. We would have created a context where we could tackle those after Arafat was gone.
Now, you say in your book, Statecraft, that anger can be a diplomatic tool if used sparingly. What's an example of a time you really blew your lid, either for theatrical purposes or because you just couldn't take it anymore?
Right. The interesting thing, and I say it in the book, anger is an effective tool if you use it at the right moments. In my case, I have to say that every single time that I used it, I never controlled myself the way I intended to. I meant to express it, but I always blew up far beyond my intention. It's always credible when you're at a point where it's believable that you would be fed up. So in my case, I was negotiating the Hebron Agreement, and I had been out there for what was close to 20 days at this point, working around the clock. And I had asked Yasser Arafat the night before to tell me what he really needed because I couldn't stay out much longer. And so he uncharacteristically ticked off 6 items of what he needed. Very uncharacteristic for him to be that clear, that focused, that precise. And so I said, okay, I'm going to go try to get these things. And I went and I spent the rest of the night. I left him at around a little after midnight or 1 in the morning in Bethlehem. And I went and I saw then Prime Minister Netanyahu. And I worked with him till about 5 in the morning, and we worked out a way to address all of the issues that Arafat said he needed. When I went back to see Arafat the next day, he suddenly denied that he'd asked for these things. And so when it was clear that he was denying this, and he asked if I was calling him a liar, I said to him, if the shoe fits. And I got up, walked out of the meeting, opened these double doors that separated us from our respective teams. We were meeting alone. And I had a binder, which was a fairly big binder. And I decided to throw it to show how angry I was. Now, what I didn't know is that there was a pitcher of grapefruit juice about 15 feet away. And I wish I was that accurate normally, because I probably could have pursued several other careers. I hit the pitcher flat on. It exploded. And I can tell you that my team and the Palestinian team were absolutely horrified. But the point had been made that I was really angry. And we proceeded to get a deal after that. Now, if you use anger at the wrong moment, before you're at a point where it's credible that you're fed up, where it's credible that you've sort of exhausted everything that can be done, including yourself, then you're less likely to have the impact.
Dennis Ross, thanks so much for talking with us.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Dennis Ross is the author of the new book, Statecraft. He's now a distinguished fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Coming up, Ken Tucker reviews Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, Miranda Lambert's second CD, which, like her first, debuted at number 1 on the country music chart. This is Fresh Air. Crazy Ex-Girlfriend is Miranda Lambert's second album. Both debuted at number one on the country music charts. Part of this seemingly instant fame may have to do with Lambert's third-place finalist status on a season of TV's Nashville Star, the country music version of American Idol. But rock critic Ken Tucker thinks it's also because Miranda Lambert, still in her 20s, is just that good.
God knows I tried everything I could to stay inside tonight. But that boy's like a sore in your mouth that you just have to fight.
That song, Guilty In Here, arrives late in Miranda Lambert's sophomore album, Crazy Ex-Girlfriend. It's the ninth of 11 tracks. The fact that this singer-songwriter felt free to bury such a terrific song is a measure of her confidence and cleverness. Guilty In Here is a fine example of modern country rock in its melody, and an even better example of old-fashioned country music lyric writing. Her central play on words, Is It Guilty In Here or Is It Me?, is a chorus both catchy and revelatory. Lambert wants you to think of her as a bad girl who'd like to find a nice guy. And another one of her lines, the good ones all got wedding rings and the young ones are just too dumb, may give heart to some nice middle-aged single men out there. For the rest of us, there's Lambert's wistful moodiness and her knack for describing small-town Texas life.
They say life is so much sweeter through the telephoto lens of fame. Around here you get just as much attention, cheering at the high school football game. I dreamed of going to Nashville, put my money down and place my bet, but I just got
Famous in a small town is like crossing John Mellencamp with the TV show Friday Night Lights. You believe Lambert grew up in Lyndale, Texas, about 80 miles east of Dallas. You also believe she has a burning ambition and a hot temper. That's what the title song of her 2005 debut album, Kerosene, was all about. And it's what she confirms in the title song of this new one, Crazy Ex-Girlfriend. Jealous and ornery, she spits out fine, vindictive lines, including, "To a hammer, everything looks like a nail." Bam.
It took me 5 bars, some 30 license plates. I saw her Mustang and my eyes filled up with rage. I brought my pistol, but I ain't some kind of fool. So I walked right in barehanded. She was on his arm while he was playing pool. Just like I used to do. She kissed him while I got a beer. She didn't think I'd show up here.
Miranda Lambert has a nice, plaintive voice, a little like early period Barbara Mandrell. She's diminutive, pretty, and compact. Look at her quickly, and she resembles a country version of Kristen Chenoweth. Lambert's songs also suggest a rather cynical view of human nature. You might ascribe that to the fact that both her parents are private investigators, which may also have made young Miranda a good trained observer of human behavior and her surroundings, always invaluable for an artist. So is a sense of humor.
Well, the road was hard and flat as a ruler, good 100 miles between me and Missoula. That vinyl top wasn't getting no cooler, so I stopped at a quickie stack.
What few songs Miranda Lambert didn't write on this album are solid covers by female writers as good and various as Carlene Carter and Patti Griffin. She's not pursuing a one of the rednecks image the way another recent star, Gretchen Wilson, has. Her music owes more to a Texas counterculturalist like Willie Nelson than the Nashville establishment that's now embracing her. The best thing about Miranda Lambert is that you get the distinct feeling that even if she wasn't putting albums in at number one, she'd still be singing in a small club about loading a shotgun in preparation for meeting a cheating boyfriend, and saying, as she does in one song on this album, that little girls like her are made of gunpowder and lead.
Ken Tucker is editor-at-large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Crazy Ex-Girlfriend by Miranda Lambert. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer is Roberta Shurrock. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Ian Chillog, Patty Leswing, Sam Brigger, and Jonathan Menjivar. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross. I'm going home, rolling low with my shotgun.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of The Histories of Herodotus, in stores and online at bn.com. From Fox Searchlight, Presenting Waitress, an uplifting comedy by Adrienne Shelley about a small-town girl with big dreams, now playing in select theaters. And from audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. audible.com/freshair. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, getting shot at while getting the shot. We talk with award-winning photojournalist Ashley Gilbertson. He spent much of the last 5 years in Iraq, capturing images of the war for the New York Times and other publications. He says photojournalists are facing increasing military restrictions in Iraq. Join us for the next Fresh Air.